From Bloomberg's Washington Bureau to our TV and radio audiences worldwide, I'm David Westin. Welcome to Balance of Power, where the world of politics meets the world of business. On The Brief today, Emily Watkins on Capitol Hill on day two of the Senate trial of President Trump. Sean Donne here with me in Washington on President Trump's new trade focus on Europe. And from Milan, Gerald Colton on Luigi Di Maio stepping down as the head of the Five Star Party. So, Emily, bring us up to speed on where things are. As I understand, all the motions, nobody made any motions, so we're going to actually start with the thing today.
Yes, today, in just about an hour's time, we are going to start seeing the House impeachment managers begin to make their case why the Senate should remove President Donald Trump from office. Yesterday was all about process, exactly how this trial is going to work. And today we start to see them actually make the case. They have 24 hours to use over the next 3 days. And I think there's a lot of people in this building who are hoping that we're not going to be here as late as we were last night.
Well, but it's over 3 days rather than two. So that was a compromise from the majority leader, Mitch McConnell. Whom are we going to hear from, first of all, on the Democrat side? Is it all going to be Adam Schiff?
I don't expect it to be all Adam Schiff. You saw yesterday Schiff make opening and closing remarks, but you also got to see all of the other six impeachment managers take some time and make some comments. I mean, all of them have been chosen for very specific reasons based on their background, based on their experience levels. And so I imagine that all of them will take a turn at the podium today to help make the case against Donald Trump.
Yeah, one of those managers we heard from actually last night was Jerry Nadler, and he got into something, a skirmish with Pat Cipollone, the chief counsel for the president, and it actually required the chief justice to intercede and say, gentlemen, let's calm down.
Yes, around, I think it was 1 a.m. in the morning. I mean, remember, this is a very unique experience for many of these senators. Usually, senators don't spend a lot of time in the chamber. They're not sitting there for hours and hours on end. And so there is a bit of an adjustment period into figuring out sort of how this is going to work, what tone is going to be set. You know, Adam Schiff used some language on the floor yesterday that I think a couple people were debating whether or not it was appropriate. It was totally allowed, but yesterday, yes, you did see them sort of come down and say, hey, when it comes to partisan bickering, that needs to be limited.
Okay, Emily, thank you so much. That's Emily Wilkins reporting once again from Capitol Hill. And now let's turn to Sean Donnan right here with me in Washington. He is our resident trade expert. We heard from President Trump this morning in this news conference, and a fair amount of it actually was about trade and specifically about European trade.
Yeah, so Europe is the great unfinished piece in Donald Trump's trade agenda. He has wanted for a few years to kind of rebalance things with the U.S., with Europe, the EU. There is a big trade deficit with the EU. A lot of it focused on cars, and Trump hatched this idea a couple of years ago to level auto tariffs at European imports to try and force Europe to the table. Well, over the last couple of days in Davos, he's doubled down on that idea again. He's doing it with a new European Commission and a new European Commission president in Ursula von der Leyen, and trying the whole thing all over again. The big question, of course, is after 2 years of trying this approach, whether it'll generate a big deal or the sort of deal that he can crow about going into the election.
And as I recall, we were on the brink, and there sort of was a truce that pulled us back from it. He has in his back pocket the autos, but one of the issues is agriculture, because as we know, the Europeans jealously guard their agriculture.
Absolutely. So in July 2018, Jean-Claude Juncker, the then European Commission president, came over here to Washington to try and stop these auto tariffs from going ahead. And they hatched what was what became known as the Rose Garden Truce, which basically allowed negotiations on some industrial tariffs and some regulatory issues to go ahead and for the U.S. to hold off on these auto tariffs. But that quickly kind of ground to a halt because the Europeans thought they had an agreement from the Trump administration not to include agriculture in any talks. The French in particular are very opposed to some of the issues that the U.S. would raise in any agriculture talks. And Congress intervened and said, we're not going to have any negotiations with Europe unless agriculture is hatched. What I'm told is the Europeans may be finding a bit of a way around this in talking about some regulatory issues with agriculture in a new round of negotiations. But whether this will work, again, is a big question.
That's the French and agriculture. What about the French and digital tax? Because as I understand it, the EU basically said individual member states can go their own way. Mr. Macron stepped up right away. away, and that really got the president's attention.
Absolutely. And so the president before Christmas threatened to impose tariffs on French champagne, French cookware, French cheese, going as high as 100% tariff on some of those things if the French went ahead with this digital services tax or didn't unilaterally disarm on it. The French have refused to do that. They say they will keep this tax in place as long as there is no multilateral agreement on tax. That there are some negotiations going on at the OECD.
Well, those have been going on for a while. What are the prospects of an OECD deal, really?
Well, that's a huge question. But what the U.S. and France have agreed to this week in Davos, and we saw it with Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron earlier this week in a phone call, and today again with the French finance minister and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin agreeing to kind of step up those negotiations towards a multilateral deal, and the French agreeing that they will not, they're kind of forego the next tranche of payments due on this digital tax. Again, the Trump administration claiming that tariffs have forced the French to cave a little bit and engage in another negotiation. But whether that negotiation is going to go anywhere is a real big question.
So President Trump's news conference this morning was remarkable, not just for his focus on Europe, but also he shared the stage with Roberto Azevedo, who is the head of the WTO, saying, here's Roberto, we're really friends now, we're going to reform the WTO. Is this a big move on WTO's part? Because this has, again, been something the president has really been fixing.
Absolutely. So the president for a long time has talked about the WTO as one of the worst trade agreements ever created, of course, created in the 1990s as a result of the Uruguay round of negotiations that the U.S. actually led at the time. Roberto Azevedo is in that kind of thankless place of having to mediate Donald Trump and the rest of the world who are the WTO's members and try and find a path towards reform. He briefed the president today on the state of those discussions. My understanding is they're not going anywhere real fast, but the president grabbed him, pulled him on stage, and really wants to take ownership of that. Again, another negotiation. We're going to have to see where this goes.
Another negotiation. He's the art of the deal. Okay. Thanks very much to Sean Donnan, our resident trade expert here in Washington. And now we're going to go to Italy and Gerald Colton. He is over in Milan, and there's big developments over there. We have Luigi Di Maio stepping down as the head of his party. What's going on? Why now, Gerald?
Well, you're probably familiar with Luigi Di Maio if you follow Italian politics. He's basically the face of the Five Star Movement, one of the key parties here in Italy. The support for the party, both internally and externally, has been hemorrhaging over recent months. The poll numbers are quite poor. Support has been slipping from inside. In fact, some lawmakers have even left the party. Some even going to the opposition. And even more importantly, the poll figures for coming regional election this weekend look very, very poor indeed for Five Star. So really, somebody has to take the fall for this, and it's going to be Di Maio.
So, Gerald, what does this mean for the coalition?
Well, initially today, the markets appeared concerned that this might mean the coalition could fall apart. We could see snappy elections. We could see even a victory for Matteo Salvini's League party. I think that on second thought, the coalition is made up of a couple parties that really need each other. Five Star is weakened, as I said. The other party in the coalition, the Democrats, are not strong enough to take on the League themselves. I think neither of these parties really it's in neither of these parties' interest to face a national election. So I think that they're going to stick together. They're going to try to find a way to forge ahead, even though they're really, frankly, two groups that don't like each other very much.
So, Gerald, finally, if the Five Star is losing support, as they have been for some time, is it going to one place? Where are those supporters going?
That's a very good question. A lot of that support is going to the League, in fact. The League's numbers have grown as Five Star's figures have fallen. And that's the main concern for both parties, really, is how strong the League is now. It's stronger than when Salvini pulled out of the government this summer.
Okay, thank you so much to Gerald Colton. He's reporting today from Milan. And now it's time to get a check on how the markets are reacting to today's top stories. Joining us now is Abigail Doolittle in New York. So, Abigail, I'm not sure it's what we've talked about so far. Is it we're not as concerned about that virus coming from Wuhan?
That's probably the bigger influence today, David, because the bulls are back in charge. Yesterday was a tad risk off on concerns around that deadly virus. But today, as you can see, lots of green on the screen. Record highs here in the U.S. for the major averages, including the S&P 500, the NASDAQ. You can see the NASDAQ really outperforming up 0.5%. That is due to tech being the best sector on the day. And behind that tech strength, take a look at the stocks of the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, really outperforming up 1.5% this before Texas Instruments reports tonight, kicking off the chips reporting in this particular earnings season, an all-time high there for the stocks. But one interesting divergence down for a third day in a row now, David, is the Dow Transports. However, certainly not down. Take a look at Tesla over the last 2 days. This morning, right on the open, crossing that $100 billion market cap, a milestone. These shares now up an extraordinary more than 200% since the lows last spring. And again, over the last 2 days, up more than 15%. On the year, up more than 40%. It's really pretty incredible. So the bulls there on Tesla really very much in charge. As for other big drivers on the day, it's really earnings. If we take a look at some of the movers here, we see IBM up about 3%. They put up a rare sales beat, the first time in six quarters where sales actually grew. Profits also beat. That may have to do with the Red Hat acquisition. Cloud really very strong for them. Netflix, on the other hand, down 2%. The U.S. subscribers, that was a miss, putting up 420 new U.S. subscribers versus the estimate of 600,000. International subscribers beat, but valuation very high, price for perfection. Shares certainly not acting perfectly. And if you can believe it, David, the last time those shares put an all-time high all the way back in June of 2018, that stock really has its work cut out for itself. Johnson & Johnson, a disappointing quarter, down 1.1%. And then, as I was mentioning, after the bell, the reporting season for the chips will be kicked off by Texas Instruments. Right now, pretty strong performance. Hopefully, their results will be as strong. Lots of expectations that the sector is bottoming out. We'll need more proof through the earnings. And we'll start to see that tonight, David, with Texas Instruments reporting.
Thanks so much, Abigail Dula. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg Television and Radio. I'm David Westin. Johnson & Johnson reported its fourth quarter earnings this morning with sales up year over year, but missing analysts' estimates, which took some off the share price. We welcome now from New Brunswick, New Jersey, Joseph Wolk. He is Johnson & Johnson Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. So, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us. So let's start out with the big question, which is the analysts got it wrong. Why? Did you underperform or did they overestimate?
David, thanks for having me here today. We're very pleased with the results, not just for the fourth quarter, but for the entire year. With respect to the investment community, we're talking on $20 billion for the quarter, about a $30 million disconnect. We can point to some one-time events, specifically in our medical device unit, where we had some elevated sales in Q3. So I wouldn't say anybody got it wrong. I think it's just solid performance across all three of our segments.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but it looks like really oncology and immunology helped drive these numbers. And I know that Alex Gorsky specifically called them out, how well they're doing. Yes. How much are they driving your results? And are you at all concerned about biosimilars and generics eating into that?
Yeah, so that's a great question, David. You know, in terms of oncology and immunology, we've got great scientists there that for better than a decade now have been bringing just transformative medicines in immunology, specifically around psoriasis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. So we point to products like Tremfya in psoriasis. I think it grew 55% year on year comparatively versus the fourth quarter of 2018. That continues to show best-in-class data. It was the first IL-23 out there. With Stelara, we're addressing patient needs for Crohn's disease. It's a debilitating disease that has tremendous uptake, but actually had its start as a product with psoriasis. So we continue to expand that portfolio with oncology. Imbruvica and Darzalex continue to perform extremely well, moving into front lines of therapy. So more patients are getting treated earlier, and we know that's the best diagnosis prognosis for better outcomes. With Darzalex, we're particularly excited about a subcutaneous formulation that we hope to get approved sometime around the first half of this year. That will take the infusion time of 6 hours down to about 5 to 10 minutes for patients, and we think that's just a big advancement for patient convenience.
Yeah. All really good news for Johnson & Johnson and for its shareholders. But what about the biosimilars? What about the generics? Are they on the horizon? Do you see any threat coming up in the future to some of that leading in immunology and oncology?
So we have had actually an impact from biosimilars this year. It was about $2 billion incremental to what we experienced in 2018. So we've been dealing with biosimilars for a few years. We had a number of products that faced loss of exclusivity. So we have biosimilar and generic competition. So, David, the great results of 5.8% growth that you see from our pharmaceutical unit was in spite of a $2 billion headwind. So we have dealt with it. We will continue to deal with it. And it's an important part of the system. You know, as we come up with new transformational medicines, we want to make sure, as all good healthcare companies do, that there's room for those to be available for patients. And so having generics and biosimilars as part of the equation in terms of overall healthcare costs is an important part.
As CFO of Johnson & Johnson, I know, Mr. Wilk, you are always looking at your portfolio, what you want to add, what you want to take away. As I understand, you referred to possible deletions of underperforming businesses today in the earnings call. Do you have any nominees? And just as important, perhaps, because I suspect you're going to say I'm not going to name any companies or any lines of business. How will you judge that? Is that margin? Is that operating profit? How do you judge whether it's underperforming?
Yep. So we look really with a mindset of being number one or number two in the markets in which we play. So do we have that level of innovation, that level of execution that ensures that we are well positioned within the markets? And if we're not there currently, we want to make sure we've got a real good game plan. When those plans don't come to fruition, and sometimes they don't, we'll look to see if we can create value for shareholders by doing something else with that asset. Similarly, though, we look to add where we can. We can complement our business. About 40% of our growth over the last decade has come from inorganic opportunities.
And finally, Mr. Wilk, talk about the donut hole, the so-called donut hole Medicare. We hear about this a lot, which, as I understand, is narrowing, and that's costing companies like Johnson & Johnson some money. Can you put any numbers around that? How much is it costing you?
Yeah, I won't put any specific numbers around it, David. What I can talk about is pricing in general, and we understand why that is a topic of conversation for the past couple of years, and certainly as we head into an election year here in the U.S. Overall pricing for Johnson & Johnson's products over the last three years, have declined. And the average on that is about 4%. So that's not a cumulative number. That's 4% each and every year for the last 3 years. We know the White House of Economic Advisors came out with a report recently, said that pharmaceutical pricing has declined in its most recent study. We need to get more of those discounts that are being generated for insurers and governments into the hands of the patients who need them most. People are walking into their pharmacies on a monthly basis paying $50, $75 for a copay when they used to pay $5 and $10. We need to make sure that that's addressed so that these great medicines that are coming, not just from Johnson & Johnson, but across the industry, are available to patients most in need.
You mentioned drug pricing overall. In your projections going to 2020 and beyond, are you putting anything in your numbers for possible legislation on Capitol Hill? Because a lot of people are talking about something maybe even this year.
Yeah, we see continued pricing pressure. As I mentioned, with Johnson & Johnson and the industry, we have seen price reductions over the last number of years. We continue to see that trend. It usually is around some of the more competitive spaces. If you think about diabetes drugs, if you think about psoriasis drugs, where there's a lot of competition, just as a free market economy should work, you're going to see price negotiation a little bit more intense.
Okay, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being with us today. That's Joseph Wilk. He's Johnson & Johnson, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg Television and on radio. I'm David Westin. Time now for our stock of the hour. Arconic is one of the worst performers in the S&P 500 today. The stock is sinking nearly 3% after it was downgraded by Longbow because of the Boeing 737 MAX. Kaylee Lyons is here with more. So I think we can blame almost everything at this point on the Boeing 737 MAX. But
well,
here's one more, Kaylee.
At least for today, yes, this may be all of Boeing's fault. The analyst over at Longbow Research, his name's Chris Olin, downgraded the stock to underperform from neutral because of the impact of Boeing. Of course, we had Boeing saying yesterday that it doesn't see the 737 MAX returning to service until mid-year, around June. That's another three-month delay. The FAA, for its part, saying that it actually has no timetable, so that could potentially get delayed even further. And Longbow sees this could have a really meaningful impact on Arconic's top line, especially he says that it could bring earnings per share down to around $2 a share and knock potentially $400 to $500 million off of commercial aircraft revenue. The reason why it's such a big impact, David, is because Boeing is one of Arconic's top customers. Actually, it's second largest in terms of revenue with about 8.3% of the revenue share. And we know that Boeing has stopped production for the time being of its Boeing 737 MAX, which could be a significant hit to Arconic's top line here.
So I understand there was a spinoff in the works. What does this do to that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The spinoff, what is going to stay in the business is Howmet, which is its aerospace division. The company is planning on spinning off what will keep the Arconic name. That's that global aluminum rolled business. And that is much lower in terms of profitability, lower margin, only about 9% in the latest quarter, whereas the aerospace business margin was above 20%. So they're trying to focus more in that area. That was seen as a possible catalyst for valuation, considering that it is higher margin. But Longbow noting that timetable may get pushed back because of the 737 MAX, David.
Okay, Kaylee, thank you so very much. That's Bloomberg's Kaylee Alliance reporting from New York.
Is abuse of power an impeachable offense?
Well, you're going to talk to the lawyers about it, but I will tell you, there's nothing here. I had a very innocent conversation with a very fine gentleman from the Ukraine, and it was based on that.
That was President Trump addressing questions about his impeachment in Davos earlier today. Welcome now Bob Livingston, who has his own experience with proceedings like these, serving as Republican congressman from Louisiana and for a time as Speaker of the House of Representatives when it was William Jefferson Clinton who was the target. So, Mr. Speaker, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much, David. Good to be here.
Let me pick up on that question specifically. Do you believe it can be, put aside the facts of this particular case, can it be an impeachable offense to abuse your power when you're President of the United States?
I think that the charge of abuse of power is so vague and so widespread that any president of the United States could have been brought up on that charge. In this case, I think it's just really baseless because it deals with a Ukrainian call, the transcript of which everybody has. Everybody can judge for themselves. And frankly, I've looked at it as a former prosecutor. I don't see any abuse of power. When we dealt with President Clinton 21 years ago, there were some firm crimes. There was obstruction of justice. There was perjury, subornation of perjury. And the fact is that President Clinton had testified under oath, and he'd lied. And there were people in prison at the time, both in the military and in the civilian corps, who had done exactly the same thing under exactly the same circumstances, but they were in jail. So when you contrast that you could justify that as an abuse of power or a crime. In this case, I don't see a crime at all.
So fair enough. There's a clear distinction between, on the one hand, the Clinton impeachment, on the other hand, the Trump administration impeachment, in the fact that they did not allege a crime in these two articles of impeachment. On the other hand, in the case of William Jefferson Clinton, while there were crimes alleged, in effect, ultimately he lost his bar membership as a practical matter for perjury. There was no accusation that what he did, the wrongdoing he did, was misusing his office in order to continue himself in office, which under the, as you know, the Federalist Papers, that's exactly what impeachment was going to. Is there a situation, put aside again the facts of this case, where a president of the United States could ask a foreign power to help him continue in office that would be so impeachable?
Well, in this case, the president didn't really do that, did he? He asked the president of Ukraine to help us unlock some corruption and to discover corruption, whether the Bidens were involved or anything else. Ukraine was notably one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And as it affected the United States, we were giving hundreds of millions of dollars to Ukraine, something that, frankly, wasn't done under the Obama administration. But we were giving them that money. And in order to put ties on the money, he wanted to make sure that it was being spent correctly. You could say the Democrats have said that's an abuse of power. I personally don't see it. But again, it depends on which party in the House of Representatives is in control. And they could virtually call any president of in the history of the country guilty of abuse of power.
And also, as we're seeing, which party is in control in the Senate as well. It goes both ways. And I want to go to exactly that point because, of course, President Trump is on trial in some sense in this proceeding. Also, I wonder if our entire system of government is on trial. That is to say, the American people are watching it. And if you look back in 1999, when there was the trial of President Clinton, and you look today, it's almost as if people are saying exactly the same things, just switching depending on whether they have an R or a D after their name.
I think many of the arguments are identical, without a doubt. In fact, many of the speeches are identical, except they're being said by somebody else. So you're absolutely right. But again, I have to contrast the underlying foundation of these charges. And in this case, I'm sorry, there's no crime alleged. Back then, there were specific crimes alleged. And when the founders drafted the Constitution, basically they were saying it's high crimes, misdemeanors, and then they specified bribery or treason. Now, you don't have any of that. In fact, the Democrats have been charging this president since the day he got elected and saying that they wanted impeachment. They had spent 2 years on a foolish goose hunt for a collusion with Russia. That right. came to nowhere. There's been this Ukrainian thing. There was firing of Comey. There were the firing of some of these other people. All of those were within the power of the president of the United States, and they could be interpreted in any way that the majority wanted them to
be. So as a former member of the House of Representatives and a former Speaker of the House, are you concerned that we are lowering the bar on impeachment overall, that we'll just have an impeachment almost with every president now? It's almost a political tool that you turn to.
David, I think that's a danger. Look, there were a lot of people that thought Bill Clinton should never have been impeached. They said it was basically about sex.
By the way, President Trump said that today in his news conference. He said Clinton should never have been impeached.
Well, I was on the other side of that, so I guess I have to disagree with him. But the fact is that there were real crimes. Now there are no crimes. And so you have to ask yourself, well, if we're going to use this one as a bar, yes, every president from now on could be impeached.
Okay. Really appreciate you being with us today, Mr. Speaker. That is Bob Livingston of the Livingston Group, founding partner. He's former congressman of Louisiana and former Speaker of the House of Representatives. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg Television and Radio. I'm David Westin. Well, people have talked for years about reforms in the World Trade Organization, but now it looks like maybe something might just get done, as President Trump made it a priority in his news conference in Davos today, where he was joined by Roberto Azevedo, the WTO head.
Talking about a whole new structure for the deal, or we'll have to do something, but the World Trade Organization's been very unfair to the United States for many, many years.
We welcome now Rufus Yerxa. He is former Deputy Director General of the WTO and former Deputy United States Trade Representative. Ambassador Yerxa is now President of the National Foreign Trade Council here in Washington. Welcome, Rufus. Good to be with you in Washington. So give us your sense of what's going on. As I say, Roberto Azevedo was up there. He introduced him. He made a few remarks. Is there a rapprochement or coming together now of the United States to the WTO?
Well, look, I think President Trump still is very skeptical of the WTO. He hasn't been a big fan of trade agreements generally and multilateralism. He doesn't like to see things that are going to restrict his power to, you know, start tariff fights and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, he seems to be acknowledging that the WTO is there and that the U.S. wants to engage in it. We'll have to see how that relationship goes. Obviously, there will still be a lot of tension between the big players. You see the fights going on between Trump and the Europeans now. And of course, the China tensions will continue. Well, those are the countries you have to make a deal with if you want to reform the WTO. So it's not going to be easy.
But as a student of the WTO, the United States has sort of cut off a lot of their funding and really, really threatened them with budgets. Have they got their attention? Is it possible that will shake something loose and have some reforms? Because you've said in the past there's room for reform of the WTO.
There's always room for reform. And in fact, there's a reform program that's been going on for a couple of years. There's been very very robust talks on digital trade, for example, on how to update the rules of the WTO for the digital economy, which were agreed to back in Buenos Aires at the last WTO ministerial. But the question now is, first of all, he has threatened to cut off funding. They didn't actually cut it off. The U.S. only pays about 13% of the WTO's budget. So remember, this is an organization with 160-plus countries. It's not easy for the U.S. to dictate all the rules there. We've got to engage in negotiation. There is room for maneuver now, and particularly if the U.S., the Europeans, the Japanese, and others can work on things like subsidies. There needs to be better reform of the subsidy rules in the WTO to deal with a mixed economy like China.
Well, you have the subsidies in China, a mixed economy without a doubt. Can you deal with that with China? Because the Europeans have said they really want to help us on that, work with us on that, without dealing with things like the common agricultural policy in Europe. I mean, some would say that there's a form of subsidy going on right now in Europe. By the way, you could say that about our own agricultural program.
Yeah, well, look, the U.S. and Europe have been fighting about agricultural subsidies for a long time. We've actually made progress. In fact, Azevedo got an agreement back in Nairobi, a couple of ministerials passed, where he strengthened the subsidy rules on agriculture. So there's been some progress on agriculture, including between the U.S. and Europe. I think they're capable of dealing with each other in the WTO on that. The bigger question is, how do you develop an alliance of countries to push China in the right direction? Mm. The problem I've seen all along is that the U.S. wants China to change, but we're busy starting trade fights with the Europeans and with our best allies in the WTO system. And, you know, Trump has to change his tune there. He has to start working with these countries, showing some leadership. If he expands the trade war with Europe, for example, by putting tariffs on autos, yeah, it's going to be very hard to get cooperation with the Europeans on how to deal with China in the WTO.
Address, if you can, briefly one specific issue, which is the digital tax. Because yeah, you talk about digital trade with WTO. We also have the OECD looking at this.
Right.
What's the proper body to resolve that problem?
So, you know, there's always this issue of what does WTO deal with? It deals with trade. And then what do organizations like OECD deal with? They deal with tax. And what's the intersection between taxation mm-hmm. and trade rules? And certainly a digital services tax raises all kinds of issues about whether you're guaranteeing foreign companies national treatment, that yeah, is the same treatment you give to your own companies. The big fight we have with the French now is they've created a digital services tax that seems to focus only on big American companies and exempts a lot of French companies. And that becomes a fight in the WTO if yeah, we can't resolve it. But there is work going on in the OECD yeah, OECD to try to get an agreement.
Yeah, as I say, it's not lost on President Trump how it would affect U.S. digital companies.
No, exactly. And, you know, he's shaking things up. The yeah, real question is, will people trust him yeah, to do deals that rely on good faith implementation right, by all members? That's the issue. It's an issue of trust more than anything.
Okay. Thank you so much to Rufus Yerxa. He's National Foreign Trade Council President, and we're going to be having more with him coming up next in the next hour on Bloomberg Radio. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg Television and on radio. This is Balance of Power on Bloomberg Television and Radio. I'm David Westin. Bloomberg Chief Washington Correspondent Kevin Cirilli has been traveling with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Kevin just spoke to the secretary in an exclusive interview from Jamaica. Kevin started by asking Secretary Pompeo about Iran-backed Hezbollah finding a foothold in South America.
When you see the scope and reach of what the Islamic Republic of Iran regime has done, can't forget they tried to kill someone in the United States of America. They've conducted assassination campaigns in Europe. This is a global phenomenon. When we say that Iran is the leading destabilizing force in the Middle East and throughout the world, it's because of this terror activity that they have now spread as a cancer all across the globe.
This past week, as you've traveled the world, we started in Germany in Berlin, where you met with world leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. You talked, I'm sure you talked about Iran, but as you know, Europe has not always followed the same strategic route as the United States when it comes to Iran. Did your meetings with European leaders move the needle in that direction at all?
Yes, sir. Look, we've been clear. We've had a different view on the right way to proceed to ensure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon, that their missile program is contained, and that this terror regime we were just talking about is pushed back. They've never wavered from the shared objective. They've just had a different view about how to proceed. But if you've seen what Iran has done, even in the past few weeks, right, it's nuclear extortion. They're now threatening to leave the NPT. So I did. I talked with my European counterparts while I was there. They have now taken a step under the JCPOA to invoke the dispute resolution mechanism. I think not only they, but the world can now see that this rogue regime has no intention of complying with the central tenets of what that agreement contained, and the world must unite to ensure that Iran never has a nuclear weapon. I saw President Macron say that yesterday. I know he means it. Now we need to work together to achieve
it. So when you say they have no intention, then how do you get Tehran to go to the United Nations, to come to the United Nations, to work with the international community aside from the sanctions and the various military response options?
Ultimately, the people of Iran will get what they so richly deserve, a regime that behaves in ways that are consistent with the value sets of the Iranian people. In the end, the Iranian people will demand their government. You see it. You see it in the protests. You see it when they walk around American flags that were put down by the Islamic Republic's leadership in an attempt to show they could show pictures of Iranian people walking over American flags. And in fact, people go out of their way not to do that. This isn't about Iran versus the United States. This is about a regime that has treated its own people terribly. The world can see it. It's a regime that even now the IAEA is trying to figure out how nuclear material got to places that the Iranian leadership said it would not be. And so this is a global risk. President Trump started his remarks the night after an American response by saying Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. It is our primary purpose. But we have a broader set of objectives too. We just want them to behave like a normal nation and re-enter the society, the community of nations.
And traveling with you all week, I mean, I'm struck by just the range of the hotspot issues around the world that are going on. And back home, the only thing that they're talking about is impeachment and the Senate impeachment trial. Did that come up at all in your conversations with world leaders? And has the Senate impeachment trial endangered U.S. interests and reputation around the world?
You know, Kevin, it hasn't come up today except where I received a question at a press conference about it, so it
and
came
you,
up.
And you said you would testify.
I've said consistently, if the law required me to testify, I would do so. You know, it hasn't come up. It almost never comes up in meetings with my counterparts. There's too many important things going on in the world. America is too close a partner today. I'm with countries in the Caribbean region here in Kingston. They care about so much that we do. They're such good friends and allies. They see the noise in Washington, but it is not something they would think in the time that we have between us that they would raise.
And House Democrats are saying that Rudy Giuliani orchestrated a shadow foreign policy. And can you assure diplomats serving overseas all around the world in dangerous places that that's not the case?
Yeah, the foreign policy we were executing then is the same foreign policy we're executing today with respect to Ukraine. It's an important country. It sits at this crossroads. It's under enormous pressure from Russia. President Trump has taken actions to counter Russia that President Obama refused to take. We've provided defensive systems for the Ukrainian people so that they can defend themselves. We've supported this new leader, President Zelensky, in his efforts to stamp out corruption and to build his democracy. We're continuing to do that. Our policy with respect to Ukraine has been set on the fundamental principles of reducing the footprint of corruption and helping the Ukrainian people build up a democracy while under threat from the Russians in the east and southeast.
You've said that you look forward to going there, that you have other issues that you want to discuss with them. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there before too long. I had a trip planned, and then we had an issue arise in the Middle East that I had to attend to. While that issue is not behind us, there's still a lot of work to do there. I'll get to Ukraine before
too long.
To
take a step back, why should Americans care about what happens in the Ukraine? What's the broader theme here? Who's explaining to the American people why U.S.-Ukraine policy matters to the average American?
Yeah. So Ukraine sits at the edge between democracy and tyranny in the easternmost parts of Europe. It's a nation that gave up its nuclear weapons at the end of the Cold War, and America made a commitment that said we would assist them with a number of things so that they could still be a secure, sovereign nation. We care about democracy everywhere. They're a huge trading partner for the United States of America. America has a number of interests with respect to Ukraine, and I think the level of resources we've committed there reflects that level of interest.
That was part of Kevin Cerulli's exclusive interview with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And Kevin joins us now from Kingston, Jamaica. So, first of all, well done, Kevin. A timely interview. Let's go back to where you started about Iran and the relationship with Iran. It's clear the Secretary is steadfast in saying they cannot get nuclear weapons. He says Europe is there as well, but I don't hear how they're going to keep them from getting them. It doesn't seem to be progress to have them pull out of the JCPOA.
Absolutely correct, and I was struck by Secretary Pompeo's assertions, continued assertions about the growing threat of Hezbollah in Latin America, and that precisely is part of the reason he traveled here and really trying to unify support not just around Venezuela President Juan Guaido, but also against broader national security themes. As it relates to Europe, Secretary Pompeo and the United States also very much trying to firm up strategy with the Europeans to get them on the same page with the United States and to get Iran to somehow negotiate with the United Nations. Now, we should note that within the past 24 hours, Tehran has said that that is something that they are not willing to do, especially should Europe continue to use the United Nations and to continue to try to work with the United Nations to have that go on. I also asked him, of course, about the Senate impeachment trial. He says it has not come up. I can tell you that the impeachment has been on the front pages of virtually every stop along our way on this five countries, five tour. But he says largely it's business as usual.
Okay, thank you so much. Once again, Kevin Cirilli, terrific job. He's in Kingston, Jamaica right now.
This is Balance of Power.
We have the strongest economy by far in the world.
We're going to grow our trade relationship.
I know what's broken. I know how to fix it.
Where the world of politics meets the world of business.
They've got the money they need to run a very competitive race.
We've got now a real crunch few days for Brexit.
We want certainty in the markets. We want certainty in our trading relationships.
The administration is trying to create a new divided world.
Balance of Power with David Westin on Bloomberg Radio.
From our Washington, D.C. Bureau, welcome to the second hour of Balance of Power. I'm David Westin. We are waiting right now for the beginning of the Senate trial to resume. They're going to have the opening arguments in a short time. We're waiting for Chief Justice Roberts to step up to the rostrum and sit in his chair, gavel it to order. It should have happened at 1 o'clock, but we will bring that to you as soon as it happens. In the meantime, we're fortunate to have Anna Edgerton here, who basically has been up all night watching this. Anna, thank you so much for joining us. Give us a sense of where we are. As I understand it, no one made any motion. Neither side made motions, which means we're going to start actually with the opening arguments.
That's right. It was a pretty long procedural slog last night until about 2:30 in the morning. So I'm sure everyone is a bit over the procedure and ready to get on with the actual argument. So a change from what we had initially expected, the House managers will have 3 days to present their arguments. They'll have 24 hours spread out over 3 days, and we do expect that to start today. So they'll have today, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday for their arguments, and then we could have a Saturday session for the Trump defense team to begin their arguments.
And as I understand, another change was that the record from the House Judiciary Committee was transferred over. And so as they have these opening statements from the two sides, they can refer, I suppose, in detail to the evidence in the record.
That's right. And it will be printed out for all the senators to have at their desk to be able to consult. So this was an interesting change that happened yesterday during a Republican lunch right before the trial opened. Initially, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had said that the House record wouldn't be introduced into the Senate record because, as a GOP aide put it, it was a sham process in the House, and you know they didn't think that it was rigorous enough evidence. But there was some pushback from Republicans, and not just the moderates you usually think of, because they want this process to hew very closely to the Clinton precedent, because that's kind of been their defense for the rules the whole time, is that we're just following what was allowed for President Clinton in 1999, and that's the best precedent we have to look to for how this should play out.
So we may have some sense of what the two sides are going to say. There have been briefs that have been submitted. There's been a lot of discussion. We've had even some indication in the procedural discussion yesterday. But one thing that may be interesting, Anna, today is the tone that's being used by the two sides. Because late last night, as I understand it, there was an exchange between Jerry Nadler, who's one of the managers from the House side, and Pat Cipollone, who's the lead lawyer for President Trump, which Chief Justice Roberts actually had to admonish them. As I understand it, Jerry Nadler said that they should be ashamed for participating in a cover-up. And in the meantime, Pat Cipollone came back and said that, in fact, Mr. Nadler is the one who should be ashamed. And the Chief Justice had to remonstrate with him. We can see now, actually, that Chief Justice Roberts has stepped up to the rostrum. He is gaveling the Senate into session. We'll be watching this because we do want to bring you the beginnings of the opening statements as they occur, as they are gathering themselves right now. They're announcing the Chief Justice to the Senate chamber, even as we speak. Up on Capitol Hill. And Anna, we will hear first from Adam Schiff, as I understand it, in the opening statements. Is that correct?
Yes, he's been the lead House impeachment manager, and he had an interesting tone yesterday. He was kind of pleading with senators almost, appealing to their sense of history, to their sense of constitutional duty. And, he struck a very humble tone, which was different than what we heard from Nadler. Like you mentioned, Nadler actually accused Pat Cipollone, the lead White House counsel, of being sent to the Senate chamber to lie, which is the point at which Chief Justice John Roberts had to jump in and say, please remember, you're addressing the world's greatest deliberative body, and we call it that because we speak to each other in a civil way. Schiff and the other managers have really tried to remember that they are appealing to senators and that they need at least 4 Republican senators to vote with them if they're going to have any chance to call additional witnesses. So it's very important that they don't alienate the people that are in the chamber with them.
Yeah, just in case we have any doubts about Chief Justice Roberts having done his homework, in that exchange, as I understand it, he referred back to something that happened at the very beginning of the 20th century where a senator was chastised for using the word pettifogging on the floor of the Senate in a trial, an impeachment trial. So we don't want to have any use of words like pettifogging. You have to go back to your dictionary and understand exactly what that means.
Goodness, no.
Yeah. So, but it is an interesting question of what role the Chief Justice plays. It was thought that he might be very quiet. We remember the Chief Justice Rehnquist, when he presided over President Clinton's impeachment trial, really only intervened one time, and I think believe it had to do with whether senators could be called jurors. As we're watching this now on a screen, we have Chief Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States, who is sitting down at his seat in front of the full Senate, and they are now actually raising their hands, saluting the flag is what's going on. It may well be a pledge of allegiance to the flag. I'm not sure. Do you know, Anna?
Yeah, they start with some ceremonial procedures with a prayer from the Senate chaplain, and then they will probably get down to business. Yesterday it started about 1:18 by the time they got through all that.
Which is an interesting point because Chief Justice Roberts is known for how punctual he is. Yesterday, as you said, they did not start at 1. They started at 1:18. Could have been because Senator Schumer, the minority leader, ran it right up just about to 1 o'clock. So there wasn't much time left over. And now we have Chief Justice Roberts addressing the Senate to begin this first full session after the procedural events of yesterday. Let's go now to listen to what's going on in the Senate chamber.
Our colleagues, no motions were filed this morning, so we'll proceed to the House manager's presentation. We will go for approximately 2 hours and take a short recess when there is an appropriate break time between presenters.
Pursuant to the provisions of Senate Resolution 483, the managers for the House of Representatives have 24 hours to make the presentation of their case. The Senate will now hear you.
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, Counsel for the President, and my fellow House managers, I want to begin by thanking you, Chief Justice, for a very long day, for the way you have presided over these proceedings. And I want to thank the Senators also. We went well into the morning, as you know, until I believe around 2 in the morning. And you paid attention to every word and argument you heard from both sides in this impeachment trial, and I know we are both deeply grateful for that. It was an exhausting day for us, certainly, but we have adrenaline going through our veins, and for those that are required to sit and listen, it is a much more difficult task. And, of course, we know our positions. You have the added difficulty of having to weigh the facts and the law. So I want to begin today by thanking you for the conduct of the proceedings yesterday, and for inviting your patience as we go forward. We have some very long days yet to come. So let us begin. When a man, unprincipled in private life, desperate in his fortune, bold in his temper, possessed of considerable talents, having the advantage of military habits, despotic in his ordinary demeanor, known to have scoffed in private at the principles of liberty, when such a man is seen to mount the hobby horse of popularity, to join in the cry of danger to liberty, to take every opportunity of embarrassing the general government and bringing it under suspicion, to flatter and fall in with all the nonsense of the zealots of the day, it may justly be suspected that his object is to throw things into confusion, that he might ride the storm and direct the whirlwind. Those words were written by Alexander Hamilton in a letter to President George Washington at the height of the Panic of 1792, a financial credit crisis that shook our young nation. Hamilton was responding to sentiments relayed to Washington as he traveled the country that America, in the face of that crisis, might descend from a Republican form of government, plunging instead into that of monarchy. The framers of the Constitution worried then, as we worry today, that a leader might come to power not to carry out the will of the people that he was elected to represent, but to pursue his own interests. They feared that a president would subvert our democracy by abusing the awesome power of his office for his own personal or political gain. And so they devised a remedy as powerful as the evil it was meant to combat: impeachment. As centuries have passed, our founders have achieved an almost mythical character. We are aware of their flaws, certainly some very painful and pronounced indeed. And yet, when it came to the drafting of a new system of government never seen before and with no guarantee it would succeed, we cannot help but be in awe of their genius. Their prescience, even, vindicated time and time again. Still, and maybe because of their brilliance and the brilliance of their words, we find year after year it more difficult to imagine them as human beings. This is no less true of Alexander Hamilton, notwithstanding his recent return to celebrity. But they were human beings. They understood human frailties even as they exhibited them. They could appreciate just as we can how power can corrupt, and even as we struggle to understand how the framers might have responded to presidential misconduct of the kind and character that we are here to try, we should not imagine for one moment that they lacked basic common sense or refused to apply it ourselves. They knew what it was like to live under a despot, and they risked their lives to be free of it. They knew they were creating an enormously powerful executive, and they knew they needed to constrain it. They did not intend for the power of impeachment to be used frequently or over mere matters of policy, but they put it in the Constitution for a reason: for a man who would subvert the interests of the nation to pursue his own interests, for a man who would seek to perpetuate himself in office by inviting foreign interference and cheating in an election, for a man who would be disdainful of constitutional limit, ignoring or defeating the other branches of government and their co-equal powers, for a man who believed that the Constitution gave him the right to do anything he wanted and practiced in the art of deception, for a man who believed that he was above the law and beholden to no one, for a man, in short, who would be a king. We are here today in this hallowed chamber, undertaking this solemn action for only the third time in history, because Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States, has acted precisely as Hamilton and his contemporaries feared. President Trump solicited foreign interference in our democratic elections, abusing the power of his office to seek help from abroad to improve his reelection prospects at home. And when he was caught, he used the powers of that office to obstruct the investigation into his own misconduct. To implement this corrupt scheme, President Trump pressured the president of Ukraine to publicly announce investigations into two discredited allegations that would benefit President Trump's 2020 presidential campaign. When the Ukrainian president did not immediately assent, President Trump withheld two official acts to induce the Ukrainian leader to comply: a head of state meeting in the Oval Office and military funding. Both were of great consequence to Ukraine and to our national interest and security, but one looms largest. President Trump withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to a strategic partner at war with Russia to secure foreign help with his reelection. In other words, to cheat. In this way, the president used official state powers available only to him and unavailable to any political opponent to advantage himself in a democratic election. His scheme was undertaken for a simple but corrupt reason: to help him win re-election in 2020. But the effect of his scheme was to undermine our free and fair elections and to put our national security at risk. It was not even necessary that Ukraine...
We've been listening to Representative Adam Schiff. He is the lead House manager, starting the opening statements from the House of Representatives, from the Democrats, laying out why they believe that President Donald John Trump should be convicted and removed from office. We started this with Chief Justice Roberts, really gabbling them in. Adam Schiff then started by thanking the Chief Justice for presiding over this. It went over out into the early hours of the morning, and also the senators for their patience. He began with some eloquent words from Alexander Hamilton on impeachment, and now he is laying out the case as he sees it for President Trump, going over territory that most of us know about at this point, and this is President Trump's conversations with President Zelensky of Ukraine and the allegation that he withheld military aid from Ukraine that he, in exchange for beginning an investigation into the events surrounding Joe Biden's son's participation in Ukraine. We will continue to monitor this. They were going to go on for 8 hours. They're scheduled for today, another 8 hours tomorrow and the day following, and then the Republicans, President Trump's lawyers, will have their opportunity to present their side of it for, again, three successive days of 8 hours each. We'll keep you up to date on any developments as they occur. We're down here to cover the impeachment trial of President Trump. But at the same time, there's a lot of other news going on, including from President Trump himself this morning talking about trade. We have with us Rufus Yerxa. He's National Foreign Trade Council President. In the first hour of Bounce Bar, we talked about some of what President Trump had to say about the WTO, the World Trade Organization. But there's a lot more going on with trade. We had, Rufus, some IMF numbers come out earlier this week, which said took down growth, global growth somewhat, but they said maybe the diminution in the rate of growth in world trade may have flattened out. It may come back up in 2020. Is that how you see it? Is trade coming back globally?
Well, I'm not an economist, so I can't really second guess the IMF, but I think all the indications are that, you know, there's going to be slightly better trade growth in 2020, but that's from a pretty bad year. 2019 was a pretty bad year, and the growth is not a spectacular increase. I think the bigger question, David, is what's the impact of all of this, the long-term effects of the trade war and the tariffs and other things on U.S. exports, U.S. manufacturing? There's certainly some numbers that have come out recently that shows that manufacturing index has declined in the U.S. It's at the lowest point it's been, I think, since 2008. And there's quite a bit of an indication of a downturn in sectors like the transport sector, which is heavily dependent on trade. So I'm still worried about the impact and overhang of all of this trade stuff on the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you do global trade growth, you're talking about a lot of different countries. And one of the things the IMF talks about is the fact that China's trade numbers are expected to come back strongly in 2020.
What is there China help on the way, even for manufacturing? Because as we looked at the numbers supposedly they've been committed to in that phase one, agriculture is something we've heard about a lot, but there was a fair amount of machinery as well in there that surprised me at least. It looks like China's committing to buy a lot of machinery from us.
So the big question overhanging this whole China deal is how is China going to perform on these commitments? And what can the U.S. do about it if they don't? The numbers that are in the agreement are, of course, spectacular. It's a little hard to believe, frankly, that we're going to see a $200 billion increase in exports to China. The Chinese have said, at the same time that they've signed this deal, they've said that deal is dependent on market conditions. They also are saying it has to be consistent with WTO. You see a number of other countries already suggesting that if there's a special arrangement with the U.S. to give preferential treatment to U.S. exports, that'll become an issue with all the other WTO countries, Brazil, Japan, Europe. And so, you know, it's not clear to me that we're going to see this kind of spectacular increase. And one other point, David. What can President Trump do to enforce what is essentially a state-to-state? You know, this is the kind of agreement that, you know, the Soviet Union used to make with its Eastern European satellites. You'll export this much and import that much. But, you know, the president doesn't have power to enforce, to force U.S. companies to export a certain amount. It depends on whether or not they have the capacity and they can compete on a price basis with others. So there's a lot of issues about these China exports that – you know, this deal doesn't really resolve.
So Rufus, you have so much experience in this, both as Deputy Director General of the WTO as well as U.S. Trade Representative at one point. Is there something of an innovation, if I can call it that, in what President Trump has done in this phase one deal in this sense? I think often in trade deals, if there's an accusation of somebody breaching it, you sort of go to an arbitration and resolve it. In this instance, it appears that both U.S. and China, I should say, have the right to judge for themselves for this violation and automatically reimpose tariffs. Is that different from what we normally see? And might it put more teeth into the deal as far as China is concerned?
Well, it is different than most other free trade agreements. The thing that worries me about that is it basically leads each side to unilaterally judge whether or not there has been performance. And we don't know on what basis those will be made. And from a business point of view, that means you have complete uncertainty as to whether or not the deal is going to stick, because either side can pull out of it at any time. The other problem with this deal, David, is, look, it's left tariffs on more than $250 billion of imports into the U.S. Many of those are products that U.S. manufacturers buy as part of their supply chain. So that tariff overhang is still there. And there's nothing in the deal that obligates the Chinese to remove the retaliatory tariffs that they imposed. So it's an odd sort of deal. We're going to increase all this trade dramatically, but we're going to keep high tariffs. That seems to me to be contradictory.
Just to add one more element to this, I referred earlier to President Trump's news conference today. He didn't just talk about the WTO. He talked about Europe a fair amount and how he's really going to be focused on Europe right now. Could we take away with the one hand what we're giving with the other as far as Europe actually getting into more of a trade spat with Europe?
I'm extremely worried about the increasing tensions between the U.S. and Europe. Look, this is the largest bilateral trade and investment relationship in the world by far. U.S. companies are heavily invested in Europe and vice versa. We have really major trade across a huge wide spectrum of goods and services and everything else. And the other thing is, historically, it was the U.S. and the Europeans who helped to develop the market-oriented rules of the WTO. And we need that alliance to be strong and robust in order to create a common front to push the Chinese in the right direction. I can't think of any time in our trade history where we've needed more cooperation between the U.S. and Europe about what the principles of the system should be. Because if we can't get the world's second largest economy to comply with those principles because we're fighting with each other, that's going to really drag down not only the WTO, but the whole international trading system.
We have a new president of the European Commission coming over, Antje von der Leyen, from Germany to meet with President Trump, I guess, in 2 weeks or so. Do you have high hopes for that?
I think so far what I've seen from her is promising. She made a statement, I think, today or yesterday, in which she suggested that there is scope for a good trade deal between the U.S. and Europe that would cover, you know, industry and services and even agriculture. You know, the new commissioner for trade, Hogan, came over here and he talked about
might get included
food safety.
That might get something done. Yeah, thanks very much to National Foreign Trade Council President Rufus Yerxa. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on a trip to Latin America, addressing concerns ranging from terrorist infiltration in the Southern Hemisphere to continuing concerns with Iran. Our chief Washington correspondent, Kevin Cirilli, caught up with the Secretary of State in Jamaica, Kingston, Jamaica, and for an exclusive interview, and here is his interview.
We were recently traveling in Colombia, and you met with Venezuela President Juan Guaido, who's risking his life to meet with world leaders, including yourself, who'll be headed to Davos. Are you hopeful that these world meetings will shift the momentum and continue the momentum against the Maduro regime?
You know, I am. When I had a chance to meet with him, he is a brave man. He's also a good leader who cares deeply about the Venezuelan people, the same interest that the United States has. And so I do hope, as he meets with European leaders when he travels to Davos, they too will see that this is a worthy and noble goal that we're engaged in, restoring democracy. The humanitarian calamity that is Venezuela now, some 6 million people by the end of this year will have fled the country, in a country the size of 30 million or so, so 20% of the population. This is a staggering humanitarian crisis, one the United States wants to do its best to resolve in a way that can only happen when there are free, fair, democratic elections that lead to the people's choice to be the leader of that country.
In Colombia, President Duque at the conference cautioned against the threat of Hezbollah in the region. And you yourself, sir, said that Hezbollah has, quote, found a home in Venezuela. How significant of a role does Hezbollah play in the region?
Yeah, too much. And I mentioned it in Venezuela, but in the tri-border area, in Brazil, This is again an area where Iranian influence, we talk about them as the world's largest state sponsor of terror. We do that intentionally. It's the world's largest. It's not just a Middle East phenomenon. So while when folks think of Hezbollah, they typically think of Syria and Lebanon. But Hezbollah has now put down roots throughout the globe and in South America. And it's great to see now multiple countries now having designated Hezbollah as a terrorist organization means we can work together to stamp out the security threat in the region.
I'm struck by this because even hearing you, what you're saying right now, I mean, to take a step back, an Iranian-backed terrorist organization has found a home in America's backyard.
It's something we've been talking about for some time. When you see the scope and reach of what the Islamic Republic of Iran regime has done, can't forget they tried to kill someone in the United States of America. They've conducted assassination campaigns in Europe. This is a global phenomenon. When we say that Iran is the leading destabilizing force in the Middle East and throughout the world, it's because of this terror activity that they have now spread as a cancer all across the globe.
This past week, as you've traveled the world, we started in Germany and Berlin, where you met with world leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. You talked, you talked about Iran, but as you know, Europe has not always followed the same strategic route as the United States when it comes to Iran. Did your meetings with European leaders move the needle in that direction at all?
Yes, sir. Look, we've been clear. We've had a different view on the right way to proceed to ensure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon, that their missile program is contained, and that this terror regime we were just talking about is pushed back. They've never wavered from the shared objective. They've just had a different view about how to proceed. But if you've seen what Iran has done, even in the past few weeks, right, it's nuclear extortion. They're now threatening to leave the NPT. So I did. I talked with my European counterparts while I was there. They have now taken a step under the JCPOA to invoke the dispute resolution mechanism. I think not only they, but the world can now see that this rogue regime has no intention of complying with the central tenets of what that agreement contained, and the world must unite to ensure that Iran never has a nuclear weapon. I saw President Macron say that yesterday. I know he means it. Now we need to work together to achieve
it. So when you say they have no intention, then how do you get Tehran to go to the United Nations, to come to the United Nations, to work with the international community aside from the sanctions and the various military response options?
Ultimately, the people of Iran will get what they so richly deserve, a regime that behaves in ways that are consistent with the value sets of the Iranian people. In the end, the Iranian people will demand their government. You see it. You see it in the protests. You see it when they walk around American flags that were put down by the Islamic Republic's leadership in an attempt to show they could show pictures of Iranian people walking over American flags. And in fact, people go out of their way not to do that. This isn't about Iran versus the United States. This is about a regime that has treated its own people terribly. The world can see it. It's a regime that even now the IAEA is trying to figure out how nuclear material got to places that the Iranian leadership said it would not be. And so this is a global risk. President Trump started his remarks the night after an American response by saying Iran will never have a nuclear weapon. It is our primary purpose. But we have a broader set of objectives too. We just want them to behave like a normal nation and re-enter the society, the community of nations.
And traveling with you all week, I mean, I'm struck by just the range of hotspot issues around the world that are going on. And back home, the only thing that they're talking about is impeachment and the Senate impeachment trial. Did that come up at all in your conversations with world leaders? And has the Senate impeachment trial endangered U.S. interests and reputation around the world?
You know, Kevin, it hasn't come up today except where I received a question at a press conference about it, so it came up.
And you said you would testify.
I've said consistently if the law required me to testify, I would do so. You know, it hasn't come up. It almost never comes up in meetings with my counterparts. There's too many important things going on in the world. America is too close a partner today. I'm with countries in the Caribbean region here in Kingston. They care about so much that we do. They're such good friends and allies. They see the noise in Washington, but it is not something they would think in the time that we have between us that they would raise.
And House Democrats are saying that Rudy Giuliani orchestrated a shadow foreign policy. And can you assure diplomats serving overseas all around the world in dangerous places that that's not the case?
Yeah, the foreign policy we were executing then is the same foreign policy we're executing today with respect to Ukraine. It's an important country. It sits at this crossroads. It's under enormous pressure from Russia. President Trump has taken actions to counter Russia that President Obama refused to take. We've provided defensive systems for the Ukrainian people so that they can defend themselves. We've supported this new leader, President Zelensky, in his efforts to stamp out corruption and to build his democracy. We're continuing to do that. Our policy with respect to Ukraine has been set on the fundamental principles of reducing the footprint of corruption and helping the Ukrainian people build up a democracy while under threat from the Russians in the east and southeast.
You've said that you look forward to going there, that you have other issues that you want to discuss with them. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there before too long. I had a trip planned, and then we had an issue arise in the Middle East that I had to attend to. While that issue is not behind us, there's still a lot of work to do there. I'll get to Ukraine before
too long. To take a step back, why should Americans care about what happens in the Ukraine? What's the broader theme here? Who's explaining to the American people why U.S.-Ukraine policy matters to the average American?
Yeah. So Ukraine sits at the edge between democracy and tyranny in the easternmost parts of Europe. It's a nation that gave up its nuclear weapons at the end of the Cold War, and America made a commitment that said we would assist them with a number of things so that they could still be a secure, sovereign nation. We care about democracy everywhere. They're a huge trading partner for the United States of America. America has a number of interests with respect to Ukraine, and I think the level of resources we've committed there reflects that level of interest.
And likewise, in contrast to Russia, you look at the situation with China. You were in Silicon Valley, I believe, the other week. Before embarking on this trip, and all throughout this region, I've seen Huawei buildings, I've seen Huawei phones, and what's your message? How do you convince our allies in this region and all throughout the region to not go that route?
You know, there's not much convincing that needs to be done about the threat from the Chinese Communist Party. They all understand it. Our task is to make sure that the risks are known to these leaders. I talked about it with each leader here that I've met with today, ranging from Haiti and the Dominican Republic and Jamaica.
Are they listening? They're not going to use Huawei?
They're trying to work their way through a set of complex commercial national security challenges that they face. And what I want them to know is the United States stands ready to support them, and we want to make sure that they understand the risk. If you put this technology into your system, you risk exposing the people of your country to having their information, their health information, their private information, their financial information, exposed to the Chinese Communist Party. It's a risk that they've all taken on board. We're working to make sure that they're as secure as they can be. And then we are, in turn, working to make sure that American information that might flow across those networks protects the American people's privacy.
All right, just a couple of final questions. The situation in Lebanon, they've had their cabinet, and they've got Hezbollah connections. Is the U.S. going to work with this new cabinet?
We'll have to take a look at it. I don't know the answer to that yet. I saw what happened over the last 24 hours. We've been very clear about the requirements for the United States to engage. Lebanon has a terrible financial crisis that lays in front of it in just the weeks ahead. We're prepared to engage and provide support, but only to a government that is committed to reform. That's important for America, but if you look at the protests that are taking place in Beirut and cities outside of Beirut, you can see, just like in Baghdad, go look at the protests in Baghdad. These aren't anti-American protests. These are protests demanding sovereignty and freedom. The protests taking place today in Lebanon are saying to Hezbollah, no mas, no more. We want a non-corrupt government that reflects the will of the people of Lebanon. If this government is responsive to that and this new set of leaders is prepared to make those commitments and deliver on that, that's the kind of government that we'll support around the world and the kind of government we would support in Lebanon.
That was Chief Washington Correspondent Kevin Cerulli in his exclusive interview with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. In the meantime, opening statements are continuing in the trial of President Trump up in the Senate. Here for an update is Bloomberg Government's Emily Wilkins. She comes to us from Capitol Hill. So, Emily, we saw the first few minutes of Mr. Schiff's opening statement. What is happening now?
So Schiff is going to continue giving his open statement. Remember, this is the first day of 3 days that House impeachment managers have. They've got 24 hours to make their argument, and we're expecting them to use much of that time. After that, they will do 16. The White House defense will go ahead and make their argument, and then senators will have the ability to ask questions. And then we're going to get to the question of whether or not we're going to see witnesses in this trial.
What is the goal, if you're Adam Schiff right now, or for that many, any of the House managers? We've heard time and time again that basically there aren't two-thirds of the senators who are willing to vote against President Trump. At the same time, is the goal here really just to persuade four senators that we need more evidence, whether it's documentary or testimonial?
You know, Schiff said earlier today that he sees this as going to two audiences. Number one, the senators, of course, but the other, so the American people, that he wants to really make this case to the American people that what President Trump did is not only wrong, but is an impeachable offense. Because at this point, it does look like Donald Trump is acquitted, then he will be facing, most likely, a November 2020 election. And Americans will need to decide whether or not they believe that that he should continue being president.
So, Emily, you're not one of the House managers, so it's unfair to ask you. But at this point, is there anything left for the American people to hear that they haven't heard already? They've heard a fair amount about this. They seem to have decided views. They seem to be relatively split on the question, certainly not two-thirds in favor of removing the president. So what new would come up that would have the American people say, oh, now I see, I have a different view?
Sure. And as far as, like, actual new things, I don't think there might be a ton. I mean, we have seen some new information, new text messages, new documents come out. But what struck me yesterday, I was sitting in the Senate chamber and just listening to the House managers and the defense make their case. And it has been a little bit rare to have one person just sort of talk for a prolonged period of time, really putting all the pieces together. Remember, most of the public process at this point has been the hearings, and those were, you know, questions back and forth, this very partisan atmosphere. Now this is the scene that it's the spark notes, in a way, of this entire impeachment trial, although I don't think 24 hours is very spark note-esque. But you're just seeing the summary and the argument sort of made, crystallized after this month-long process.
Okay, Emily, thank you for your continued great reporting from Capitol Hill. That's Bloomberg Government's Emily Wilkins. President Trump is on his way back from Europe, but not before saying there's a lot of work to be done on U.S.-European relations. Lord Mark Malik Brown has had a remarkable career in public service, serving in senior positions at the World Bank as Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, and then as Minister of State in the Foreign Office of Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He is now with Eurasia Group, and he joins us now. Welcome, Lord Brown. It's really great to have you with us. Give us a sense of U.S.-European relations right now, because this has been a focal point because of Davos, which you've been to more than once, I know. It's a focal point. But what is the state of U.S.-European relations, would you say?
Well, it's a little troubled, and that won't come as a surprise to your listeners. There's the trade issue, which still remains difficult, with a technology tax threatened by the Brits and others, which, you know, is complicating the trade relationship. But beyond that, there's real difficulties in the security relationship, where Europe's beginning to think of a Europe without the U.S. protective umbrella. And so, you know, it's a troubled moment. That said, I really don't think there's anyone in Europe who doubts that the transatlantic relationship is the core foreign policy relationship, not just for the U.K., but for Europe as a whole.
So as a Briton, but also as a European, can you summarize how you think Europeans, particularly European authorities, regard President Trump at the moment? Obviously, people didn't really know him, I don't think, very well when he came to office. He doesn't handle things the way I typically think of diplomats as handling things. At the same time, is there a sort of a sense that he's rough and ready? He's getting things done, for example, like the China trade deal and like the USMCA, that successor to NAFTA. It might not be always pretty or elegant, but he sort of gets the job done.
Look, I think people would acknowledge he is getting some stuff done. And I think, you know, the smarter Europeans respect some of the disruptive impact that he has. You know, they recognize that, for example, Europe was really not carrying its weight in terms of its contribution to NATO. So some messages, which are a continuation of those delivered by the Obama administration before, but delivered much more robustly and occasionally undiplomatically, I think there is respect for. But I think what the Europeans struggle with is the sort of unpredictability of the Trump administration, the fact that that decision seems so centered on the president himself, but in terms of his own personality and the lack of institutional constraints around him or wise voices around him, European leaders just find that a very uncomfortable situation. And because they recognize that there is a long-term rebalancing of the U.S. from Europe towards its Asian responsibilities, I think the acceleration of that under Trump worries Europeans.
Lord Brown, talk about one specific issue that very much involves Europe, and by that I certainly include the United Kingdom, and that is relations with Iran and its development of nuclear weapons, because to some extent it looks to us like Europe is almost caught in between Iran on the one hand and the U.S. on the other hand. We've just heard from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that we are all agreed, including the Europeans, that we have to stop Europe from Iran from developing nuclear weapons. What is Europe's position on this? What is the way to get that done? Withdrawing from JCPOA, is that the way to get it done?
Well, it's not what the Europeans want, but you know they're recognizing that the game is changing, that the goalposts are moved by the actions that President Trump has taken, and you know it's one where you know they recognize how difficult it was to get the JCPOA done. It came after years of conflict. There was a recognition at the time that just doing something limited around the nuclear weapons issue was the way forward, and let deal with broader issues of the relationship between Iran and Europe and Iran and the U.S. later. That whole process was thrown on its head by President Trump, and Europeans, with that historical memory, think it's very unlikely that it'll be easier to do a broader agreement. But nor do they want to leave themselves in a position where they seem to be protecting Iran from, you know, the errors of its ways and somehow a buffer between it and the U.S. So they're very uncomfortable with this. They don't agree with the direction of American diplomacy, but nor do they want to desert the U.S. on this one.
Lord Brown, let's come back to your home country of the United Kingdom. Brexit passed today, as I understand it, Parliament. After all the falderal for over 3 years, it seems to have been almost lost in the rounding between an impeachment trial here and a Wuhan virus and Davos and things like that. What is next in Brexit? I mean, where does that take the United Kingdom? Where does it take it in relationships with Europe and, for that matter, the rest of the world?
Well, let's be clear. The next reading passed. It's still not quite a done deal yet, but it's almost as good as done. It'll be done, you know, by the end of the month, and you know there will be quite a brouhaha with some ceremonies and celebrations by the government on the 31st of the month. But you know, why, in a sense, has the sort of pain and grief gone out of it? Because, in a sense, this result was discounted by markets and by political observers once Boris Johnson was returned with a thumping majority at the election in early December. And, you know, I think many of us feel, even if we didn't like the result, that it was a return to the legitimacy of parliamentary government. We'd all been quite uncomfortable with this fact that thing was initially put to a referendum and then there was talk, which I supported the lack of a good alternative of a second referendum. But for a country which is, you know, the inventor of parliamentary democracy, this was an uncomfortable way to go. And the fact that there was an election, that the government won on its proposition of getting Britain out of Europe by the end of January, you know, I think the country's ready to respect that result.
You have negotiated any number of complicated, difficult international relations. Does the UK have the firepower, as it were, to negotiate all of the arrangements it needs to by the end of this year?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, I think in that sense, the claim that Brexit's over on the 31st is a claim that many will come to revisit, because there are going to be agonizing trade negotiations running for a long while to come. The government has said that the main one with Europe has to be concluded by the end of calendar 2020.
Right.
And they very much hope to get the U.S. one done before the presidential election in November. But in truth, you know, there just isn't, as you say, the firepower, the expertise. We deferred trade negotiations to Brussels. And in fact, when it comes to firepower, Europe, as a much bigger market, is able to command a lot more concessions from trade partners than Britain alone. So there is neither the expertise or the weaponry to get the trade agreements that the government hopes for.
A good long way to go. Okay, thank you very much. It was a delight to have you with us. That is Lord Mark Malik-Brown of the Eurasia Group.